This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
We might make a start. Hello everyone and welcome to the second annual public lecture on future directions in Indigenous research. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Tony Mackay and I'm the Dean of the College of Arts and Social Sciences here at the Australian National University. Before we get started, I'd first of all like to welcome Ngunnawal Elder Auntie Susan Barry to the stage for the official Welcome to Country.
Today I would like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, the United Ngunnawal Elders Council, all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders and non-Indigenous friends here today. Thank you for inviting me to conduct the Welcome to Country. For those who may not be aware, Welcome to Country is a protocol which is ancient. Before entering another person's country, one would always announce your arrival and not enter until the traditional owners welcome you. The reason for this practice is to protect your spirit and to show respect for the people for whose country you are entering. The Ngunnawal people are the traditional owners of the ACT and region. As with all Aboriginal communities, our community is made up of several family groups who represent the interests of the Ngunnawal people. Now I would like to read to you a charter that has been developed by Ngunnawal elders in 2003. I hope it is an inspiration to you and the work that you do. United Ngunnawal Elders Charter. Our unity is a journey of healing. We have taken the first big step and along the path people will join with us and leave, but everyone is welcome. In welcoming people, we know the following to be true, that our elders have our respect. We are honoured by their giving respect back. We acknowledge them for assuming responsibility as leaders in our community. We need to come together to create our future, one in which everyone has a place where they can feel proud, have dignity and feel they belong. That communication is everything, and we do this in a supportive way to know more about each other, our history and our culture. These knowledges we make are ours together, although it belongs not only to us, but it's also for our kids and grandkids too, and it is for them that we do this work now. It takes courage to do work for the greater good. We need to learn how to solve problems, include, not isolate, to listen with our hearts and speak with our souls. In being courageous, we are a direct link back to dream time, and this is the essence of Aboriginality, as is our relationship to the land. In this journey, we strive for unity. We do this by empowering people, creating confidence, self-esteem and room for difference, so we can work and laugh together, moving forward all the while. We each and every one of us want this, not only for ourselves and our families. We want this too for the people who need it the most. On behalf of all Ngunnawal people, both past and present, I am happy to welcome all of you here today to the lands of the Ngunnawal people. May the spirit of this land comfort, heal and guide us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susan. We're grateful that you could join us here today to open this lecture. This is actually the second year that the College has hosted a public lecture showcasing future directions in Indigenous research, and we'll be hearing from Dr. Melinda Hinkson about her research, which has culminated in her book and this wonderful exhibition here at the National Museum, Drawing Life, Walpuri Lines on a Changing World. Around this time last year, we heard from Dr. Jennifer Dager, who spoke about her research into the ways that the Ngunnawal are using digital technology to record and share their histories and their stories. These lectures are an opportunity for the College to highlight and share with the public some of the innovative work of academics across the College in Indigenous research and community outreach. One of the reason why we started this series was, in fact, we were thinking about how we could make a contribution to reconciliation and highlighting areas of importance for improving the lives of Indigenous people. And we decided that although we do an awful lot of work in the Indigenous space, actually we tend to just be talking with our colleagues or with the Indigenous communities with whom we are very grateful to be able to work with. And we decided that a public lecture was an opportunity for us to actually highlight the kind of work going on. So I'd really like to both acknowledge members from across the college, because it's an opportunity for them to hear about Indigenous work going on in different areas, but also members of you who've come from the public to listen to the lecture. And what better place to engage in public outreach than Australia's National Museum? One of the things that I think is very striking is the changing generation that's occurring in our academic staff and the use of new and innovative ways of sharing their research from the older generation. And so the use of exhibitions and the use of digital technology and so on is becoming much more common in academic practice as a way of reaching out across the broader community. Perhaps one of the hallmarks of Indigenous research in the college is that we really do attempt to improve our understanding, to influence policy and make a real difference in Indigenous communities. For example, the Centre for Aboriginal and Economic Policy Research is one of the most trusted sources in Australia for research on Indigenous economic issues. And the film screened at ANU last week, Message from Mungo, coordinated by Professor Anne McGrath, uses film innovatively to share that particular project's research outcomes. And it's been very well received and it's been nominated for a number of awards. And that's just two examples across the strength of the college in Indigenous research. And we really are cross-disciplinary. We cover areas as broad as music, anthropology, art, language, history, and the list just goes on. Tonight, however, we're really lucky to be hearing from Melinda. She is a social anthropologist with wide-ranging interests in visual culture. She's published extensively on the Walpuri's engagements with visual media, on the life work of anthropologist W.E.H. Stanner, on the contested cultural politics of the Northern Territory intervention, and on the broader field of contemporary cultural attitudes to images. Very importantly, Melinda is an ARC Future Fellow in the School of Archaeology and Anthropology. You might wonder why that's so important. Well, it's the funding that is provided to us from the Australian Research Council. And if I might make a little plug for the funding of the Research Council, because in the humanities and social sciences, it's actually pretty difficult for us to raise money from industry for the kind of work we often do. We are very dependent on the funding that we get from the Research Council, and contrary to what some people might think, I think that our work is very relevant, it makes a difference, and it's very important to the nation. Melinda and the purpose of the Future Fellow is that it really gives an academic time away from the day-to-day activities of teaching to just focus intensively on their research and their outreach. And so it's a very important scheme and it's very hard to get. So Melinda is a special person in the college because she's one of the few people that we have that have been successful in the ARC Future Fellowship. Although I should also add another plug, and that is that we do better above the odds than other colleges around the country. She has had an extensive experience in teaching. She's convened a postgraduate program in visual cultural research and taught courses in the history of anthropological theory, the anthropology of media, and interdisciplinary visual studies. Straight after the lecture, I hope you'll join us for a reception. Last year when we did it, people sort of rushed out and didn't realise that we had a reception, so we do have that. And importantly, Melinda is also will be signing books, so you'll be able to have an opportunity to purchase her book and to have it signed personally. Also, I think that our preferred format is that we won't be having questions right at the end, but Melinda's very happy to talk to people in a more informal setting, more collegial setting, a few drinks and a little bit of food to talk more if you've got more in-depth questions that you want to ask her. So without further ado, please join with me in welcoming Dr. Melinda Hinkson.
Wait, you've taken my notes, Tony. Could make for a very short lecture. Thank you very much, Tony. Hello, everyone. Wonderful to see you all. Thanks very much for coming. And thank you, Susan Barry, for your very warm and gracious welcome to country. I'm particularly grateful to the College of Arts and Social Sciences and to the ANU Reconciliation Action Plan Committee for inviting me to give this lecture today. Indeed, it's a rare honour to have the opportunity to present one's research in a public forum with such a level of institutional support. And can I just single out Kathy Goff, if she's here, for a special thanks for all the work she's put into organising today. And to our hosts at the National Museum, thanks once again for your really terrific support for Walpree Drawings. Behind the research I'm going to talk about today lies a crucial network of collaborations involving the museum, the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies, the Walpree Arts Centres, Wanayaka and Wallakalongal, as well as the contributions of many Walpree friends. I'm deeply grateful to all of them. A few words of background before I get properly into this paper. Mervyn Meggett, an anthropologist, deposited 169 drawings at the Institute of Aboriginal Studies in 1965, where they were archived as research materials. I learned about the Meggett collection during a brief period of employment at the Institute 15 years ago. I was mesmerised by these drawings, but it was more than a decade before I was able to initiate this research. By the time I did, all of the makers of the drawings and Mervyn Meggett were deceased. The only documentation for the drawings was a transcribed audio recording made by Meggett, in which he describes the content of each drawing and offers his views on their artistic significance. Further documentation was produced in 1980 by ethnomusicologist Stephen Wilde, who went up to Walpree country and sought advice from men about the drawing status. At this time, 50 drawings were identified as dealing with restricted men's themes, and these were separately filed away. Before I commenced my research, Stephen consulted a new generation of Walpree men to ensure that they approved of the drawings being made the subjects of a new research project. They confirmed that 120 drawings were appropriate for circulation. So, equipped with the documentation, laminated prints and digital files of these drawings, and accompanied by a small research support team, including the wonderful Hannah Quinn-Liven, who's here with us today, we headed for Walpree country. Now, just to give you your bearings, Alice Springs is here, 300 kilometres northwest is Yuendumu, where the major focus of my work has gone on, and another 600 kilometres up the road is Lajumanu, or Hooker Creek, as it was known at that time. Drawings for making white people happy. Late one afternoon in early February 2011, I'm sitting in the yard of the widow's camp as dramatic storm clouds form overhead. A woman in her 70s takes a mobile phone from the hands of a younger woman and thrusts it towards me. The screen displays a satellite image of Cyclone Yasi, which at that time is hurtling towards the Queensland coast, thousands of kilometres to the northwest. Look, she urges, pointing to ears on either side of the head of this beast. Mamu, monster. Later that night, Walpree children dive under their beds in terror as alarming sounds of and pictures of cyclone warnings are televised. Central Australia receives satellite broadcasts from Queensland, confirming some viewers' fears that the cyclone is bearing down upon them. The following morning, old women tell me they had prayed through the night for the people of Queensland. The timing of the trip to reintroduce drawings made by Walpree people at Hooker Creek in the 1950s coincided with a series of dramatic events, social as well as climactic. A protracted interfamily feud had erupted at Yuendumu following the death of a young man 4 months earlier during a drunken fight in an Alice Springs town camp. Three young men were in prison, awaiting trial on charges relating to this death. In the aftermath of violent retribution that followed, a group of 100 relatives of the men in prison left Yuendumu and sought refuge nearly 2,000 kilometres south in Adelaide. Those who remained in the township lived with daily outbreaks of fighting, with constraints on their ability to move around the town. an increased police presence, frequent arrests of people on charges of assault. Tensions were high, with much of the productive activity of the town, as well as school attendance, deeply affected. In the midst of this turmoil, the Art Centre remained a place of relative calm and focused creative work. It was here that we made our first public presentation of the drawings. Senior women greeted these pictures with surprise and delight, and with much emotion as the pictures brought to the surface memories of long-lost loved ones. Over 4 mornings, we pinned prints to the external walls of the building so they would catch the attention of people as they came and went in this busy space. One morning, a senior man turned up and paused to look at the pictures on display. A retired schoolteacher, sometime painter, ritually active man, Japongari Poulsen was an acute interpreter of Walpuri history and a keen observer of the world at large. His eyes scanned the pictures briefly. He shook his head and he smiled. "They're only for making white people happy," he told me. "Oh dear," I thought. I asked him to explain what he meant. He went on to distinguish drawings he described as cheap from those that were valuable, and he pointed out several examples of each. And this emu was one of the supposedly cheap drawings. Now, I was bewildered by some of his identifications, as I knew the subject matter of several drawings he placed in the Whitefella camp to be treatments of important ritual themes. And indeed, Larry Jungerai had described the red emu to Mervyn Meggett as being red because red was the colour of blood, the colour of power, and emus were powerful creatures. So what was going on in this interpretation 6 decades after the drawings were made? Japongari's distinction seemed to turn upon 2 criteria. First, whether a drawing depicted its subject matter as it was seen or deployed classical Walpuri iconography, and second, whether it appeared to have been completed with care or was roughly drawn. On reflection, I could see that Japongari was distinguishing images that presented objects as able to be apprehended by the European eye from those that followed Walpuri conventions of picture making, wherein the most potent forces are rendered and understood to lie beneath the surface of visibility, accessible only to those educated in how to read them, most properly in ritual contexts. In elaborating on his distinction between drawings made to make white people happy and those that were important to Walpuri, Japongari spoke about cave paintings and engravings, pictures embedded in places, as being the really important pictures. He then moved on to tell me he was critical of people bringing rough work to the Art Centre, boomerangs and other wooden objects that were not finely worked, not properly planed or sandpapered. He suggested, "You can tell by looking at something whether it has been made just for money. The key marker of quality," he proposed, "is care. One can clearly see when an object or a painting has been truly cared for by its maker. The ultimate significance of such an attitude," Japongari said, "was that only when a person cares for a picture, really thinks about what one is doing and handles the material with sustained attention, only then can one feel good about oneself." The following day, this man returned to talk to me again. "I've been thinking about this some more," he told me, "and I've changed my mind. Those drawings are important ones, all of them. I'm going to show you why." Over a period of days, he mounted a forceful argument in pictorial as well as spoken form for reinterpreting some of the apparently secular or cheap drawings, drawings which Meggett had described as objects just there, receiving the artist's attention, as in fact dealing with Walpuri high culture, with restricted men's sacred themes. Initially dismissed as cheap copies, the drawings were now identified as significant works of cultural value. Now, Japongari's thoughtful engagement with the drawings heavily influenced the inquiries I pursued over the next 3 years. And indeed, my book is dedicated to the memory of this remarkable man who died unexpectedly in the middle of last year. He fueled my determination to make sense of the complex entwining of what once would have been identified as distinct Walpuri and European cultural attitudes. If the early 1950s, the time of the making of the drawings, marked the beginning of a new sedentary life for Walpree and the coming of a new world order, the time of their introduction to a new generation of Walpree people was an apposite moment to consider the weight of six decades of change. Now, all I can do today is scratch the surface of these matters, and I'll do so by revisiting a number of interactions around the drawings. Those of you who are interested to delve more deeply into the larger story behind Japangari's responses might be interested to read my book. As I've said, by the time I commenced this research, all of the makers of the drawings and the man who collected them were deceased. Meggett did not write about the drawings in his celebrated ethnography, Desert People, and he destroyed his unpublished Walpree research materials prior to his death 10 years ago. People are often bewildered when they hear of research materials being destroyed, so it's worth pausing to reflect upon why he might have done so. Mervyn's widow Joan recalls lengthy discussions with her husband over the status of his field notes as imprecise records of the observation of events. Mervyn had been a boarding school pupil and a naval officer, and he was meticulously organised. For him, anthropology was a science dealing with things about which one could be certain. On the eve of his death from lung cancer, Mervyn made the decision that he would not leave what he regarded as inconclusive materials around to be misinterpreted by a future generation of researchers. The only living connection we have to the field in which these drawings were produced is 89-year-old Joan Meggett, who was with Mervyn at Hooker Creek and indeed was here with us in mid-August when we launched the exhibition and the book. Japangari's suggestion that the drawings were made to make white people happy acquires a curious twist when we bring Joan's memory into the frame. She recalls the night Larry Jungerai visited their house and handed Mervyn this drawing. The Walpree man watched her husband's face and asked if he knew what the drawing was. Mervyn eyed the picture and he shook his head. As Joan recalls it, Jungerai looked at Mervyn in utter astonishment, as if he were a fool. "What is it?" asked the anthropologist. "It's the Mullica's house," Jungerai exclaimed. By way of this one drawing and the lines of inquiry it triggers, we can glimpse a series of interrelated matters. The circumstances of Walpree people's lives through the early to mid-20th century, as well as Walpree attitudes and creative responses to those circumstances. Through this inquiry, Jungerai's drawing also invites us to reflect upon the limits and possibilities of cross-cultural interaction at the time of the making of the drawings, as well as on what we, six decades removed from that place and time, can possibly know. The time of straight lines. The early 1950s marked a turbulent time for Walpree. 2 decades of sustained pressure and competition with pastoralists and miners for access to hunting grounds and precious water sources finally resulted in the displacement of Walpree to government settlements, a new kind of place that would bring into being a new world order. The establishment of settlements was marked by a contradictory impetus to provide welfare and security, to relieve Aboriginal people from the brutality, sickness, and starvation that had become widespread, but also to train them in the ways of routinised work and sedentary life. Settlements were places for the cultivation of a new, work-ready Aboriginal subject who would provide labour for surrounding cattle stations. The superintendent was the figure who embodied these contradictory tendencies of care and control. The same man who distributed rations and administered medicine also forced people to work, threatened to withhold rations, and shot disobedient dogs. On many occasions, he made clear his authority and way of seeing were not to be challenged. At the height of a prolonged drought, 130 Walpree people were trucked into this partly built settlement at Hooker Creek that was dangerously ill-prepared to deal with their basic needs. In the days that followed, a Gurindji man presented himself as the senior rainmaker of the region who had come to help. The superintendent instructed him to return directly to Wave Hill. In this harsh environment, where a new settlement and governmental order was being crafted out of the desert, only one mode of authority would be tolerated. The Hooker Creek Daily Diary, meticulously kept by the superintendent, provides a fascinating glimpse of the circumstances Walpi people found themselves in. At this place of Kuwinyujukupa, mosquito dreaming, flies and biting insects were often thick in the air. There were long periods of dry, searing heat with hot winds, followed by nerve-wracking periods of stillness that brought the settlement's windmill-powered water supply to a halt. Through the early months of 1953, just prior to the Meggetts' arrival, conditions steadily worsened. Among the people brought to the settlement were a number who were gravely unwell. An elderly man and an elderly woman died days after arrival. A baby died. Racked by grief, the child's mother and extended family left the settlement, walking hundreds of kilometres through the desert back to Yundamu. They would not be the last to do so. In carving out of the arid desert a new settlement that would meet the needs of hundreds of people, a raft of urgent tasks required attention. Constructing houses, securing water supply, digging lavatories, clearing an airstrip, planting trees and vegetable gardens, carting firewood, servicing vehicles and boars, cooking meals, tending the sick, killing and butchering cattle. Hard labour lay at the heart of the new settlement regime. And the work of erecting the veranda and fly screen that encased the superintendent's house was elaborate and time-consuming. It absorbed the energies of Superintendent Petherick and those he identifies as three boys over a three-week period in January 1952. Completion was delayed when the superintendent allowed his labourers to enjoy a long weekend of ceremonial activity in recognition that they had been working well. Larry Jungerai's attention to the geometric structure of the house echoes the lines of fence posts Walpi men were enlisted to cut from trees, the straight roads they cleared, the ground they levelled for the airstrip, the lines of tin huts they erected, the straight lines senior women recall being made to stand in while they waited to receive rations. In the history of settlement, the straight line recurs often, indicating so many elements of a new cultural attitude to which Walpi were subjected. With this context in mind, it is impossible not to read Larry Jungerai's mesmerising drawing as a response to world-changing circumstances. Drawing, it seems, was a mechanism for coming to terms with profound dislocation, a world that could no longer be explained by recourse to Jukurpa, Walpi law, a world in which new creative responses were called out and urgently required. The proximity of Jungerai's attention in close-up seems to indicate the intensity of his gaze. His drawing forces the viewer to confront the structure itself, the fly screen, the wooden frame, the window, the house from every possible angle, the light glowing within are all condensed. The vigorous shimmer of yellow, green, blue that gives this picture its charge is an effect that Larry worked up and then replicated across a number of drawings he made for Meggett. It's an effect he seems to have perfected in order to convey liveliness and power in a range of contexts, primarily ancestral power, the power of country, but also, perhaps in this instance, the power of the superintendent. If drawing is, as John Berger and Michael Tausig have suggested, a mode of sense-making, might it be that Larry's drawing is an exercise in grappling with the implications of this structure, not simply as a curious object in the landscape, but as symbolic of the new regime, its forms of power, and the new way of life he was coming to terms with? Larry Jungerai's adopted daughter, Tess Napaljari, drew my attention to this drawing being a view from the other side of the colonial encounter, and more specifically, of light shining within the house. Her father, she surmised, would have walked past this house every day and would have seen the light shining in the night. In this drawing, the perspective of the observer is not the customary view from the window looking out, but that of the outsider looking in. While Walpi people were being subjected to this new regime in which the grid and the straight line, as well as new forms of illumination, would come to have such significance, Larry Jungerai's drawing reminds us that they returned the gaze with intensity. Now, Mervyn Meggett may have failed to recognise the superintendent's house in Larry Jungerai's drawing because his eyes had been trained to look for and see different things in the drawings made by Walpi men. Drawings of country, of ancestral journeys, were the primary subject matter of the pictures made for Meggett. But given the monumental change Walpi were experiencing, might it be that Larry drew the house in an attempt to shift his interactions with the anthropologist, to commence a new kind of conversation dealing with the here and now of the settlement and the question of what life would be possible for the Walpi who found themselves living on Gurindji land at Hooker Creek? Importantly, Jungerai was not the only man to draw the house. Willie Japongati surveys the scene from a further distance, placing the house in its surrounding environment with clear blue sky separating the structure from the yellow spin effects ground, which we see around the edge of the drawing here. Japongati appears to highlight that these strange new people live very differently from Walpi above the ground. His impenetrable black box might also be read as evoking a very different sensibility to Jungerai's shimmering picture, with its unmistakable warmth and openness to the light glowing within. These drawings of the house encourage the posing of such questions, and as indicated, I've been led to do so by contemporary Walpi responses. In perhaps the most compelling element of this research, drawings have been taken up not simply to reflect upon people and times long since past, but as touchstones for making sense of the pressing circumstances of the present and to channel hopes and fears for the future. Old monsters newly seen. One morning in late May 2013, I'm sitting with April Nupaljari, a daughter of Larry Jungerai's brother, on the sparsely grass ground beside her house in an Alice Springs town camp. A sign on the front fence of Nupaljari's dwelling, with its neat yard, declares it to be an alcohol-free zone. I had visited this house briefly the previous afternoon and introduced Larry Jungerai's drawings to this woman. She was visibly moved to see these pictures and upbeat at the prospect of me returning the following day to share her memories of her father and his brothers. However, this morning I find Nupaljari more reserved, deferring to the superior knowledge and memory of her absent brother, the man I had hoped to meet at this house, but who had left for the distant township of Kintore the previous day. Among his more explicitly anthropomorphic pictures, Larry Jungerai produced drawings of Janba, malevolent beings. These Janba pictures, two by Jungerai and another two by A.B. Jungala, are distinguished as the only drawings Meggett directly referred to in his published writing. Meggett's account of Janba tracks the appearance of these beings in ceremonial narratives and songs. He reports having attended Janba-related ceremonies in December 1953, where Larry Jungerai and A.B. Jungala, classificatory brother-in-law, danced together. Meggett describes Janba as malicious beings who on occasion seem to be wholly immaterial and to possess miraculous powers, yet have many human qualities and frailties. He lists the countries where Janba are known to reside. Janba were known to prefer sandhill country, to make their camps near rock holes surrounded by trees and dense vegetation. Walpi men told Meggett Janba were capable of moving through the air at extraordinary speed. Walpi could not see Janba, but yet had a clear sense of their physical characteristics. They were black, very black, blacker than Walpi people, with coarse hair that stood straight up, or headdresses that created the same effect. Their eyes were blood red, and their mouths similarly a terrifying blood red. They had huge penises that were always partially erect. They were left-handed, whistled like birds, although they could speak if they wished. They wore emu-feathered boots and were invisible to all but dogs, ngankuri, or medicine men, ancestral heroes, and karia, or white people. Their invincibility meant Jianpa could enter a camp and steal anything they liked. In the dark of night, people would extinguish fires if there was a concern that Jianpa were close by. Jianpa were known to take human wives. These women, as well as small children, were abducted when out hunting alone. Women were said to remain with their abductors because the sexual prowess of Jianpa kept them satisfied. Those who were not taken as wives were raped and killed. Jianpa left telltale signs of their crimes. They snapped the necks of their victims by twisting the head back over the shoulder. Another signature method involved killing a victim by fatally damaging an internal organ. The afflicted person was killed but brought back to life for 2 or 3 days before they fell down dead. What Meggett did not report, and perhaps was not told, was that Larry Jungerai's family held that one of his young sisters had been abducted and killed by Jianpa in the time they lived in the bush. Looking at these Jianpa drawings with Napaljari, seated in her yard in Alice Springs, I'm struck yet again by the way the 1950s drawings get taken up to animate current concerns. Meggett describes one figure, not as Jianpa, but more ambiguously as a man walking around in the night, going to urinate. As I hand this drawing to Napaljari and read Meggett's description, she grimaces with recognition. Jianpa, she says. I ask her to tell me about Jianpa. Pointing across the town camp, she says she sometimes sees them silhouetted against the lamppost in the distance at nightfall. They come out at sunset. That's the real time for Jianpa. In the long shadows that form at that time of day, you can see them. They live in every country, in the Yulkuru, in the scrub. In the bush, they are often close to kurkara, desert oak trees. They look like kurkara. Hairy trees, hairy men, guraicha, she says. They do not talk. In earlier times, Napaljari tells me, Jianpa were not people, but really Jianpa. They tried to get good-looking girls, nice-looking girls with oiled hair and skin. They used to stay around the big dam at Yuendamu, a favoured drinking place just outside the 10-mile boundary of community-enforced alcohol prohibition. Today, she tells me, people are trying to turn themselves into Jianpa. They make themselves invisible. They've seen things on movies that they copy. They learn skills like ninja out in the bush. These new Jianpa people come into houses. They look at the layout of people's sleeping positions so they can come back later in the dark and kill a person. There are lots of these Jianpa people now, and lots of people are being killed, she tells me. I've heard similar stories from other Walpi friends, accounting in part for the high levels of anxiety that currently pervade the community. Whereas in earlier times Meggett reported that fires were extinguished to ward off Jianpa, in the present, Napaljari leaves the lights on around the perimeter of her house all night to ward off these devils. She calls the lights her angels. Most important, however, is the presence of God. Wapara looks out for us, she says. He's the big one. He stops them like a shield. You see them coming along that road, she nods in the direction of the highway, as the sun is going down. They can't come to this house. I don't drink. I pray to Wapara. That trouble is over now at Yuendamu, Napaljari continues. Only here in town we have these problems. They shouldn't come round here looking for fights. If they want to fight, they should go to Afghanistan. Now, Napaljari's narrative fed into a swirling visual economy I'd been grappling with, one in which pictures of cyclone monsters were Bluetoothed between mobile phones, rain snakes were observed circling the sky above the Alice Springs prison, passing judgment on incarcerated inmates, dramatic media reports announced army deployments to Aboriginal towns, sparking fears that soldiers were coming to take children away. A government announced national emergency identified Aboriginal men as child abusers. An escalation of increasingly brutal attacks in Alice Springs, reported and real, all converged. The economic base of this visual economy was marked by increasing levels of unemployment and few opportunities for sustained meaningful activity. The tightening of government regulation of many aspects of Walpi people's lives, the outlawing of customary law practice, and alarming rates of imprisonment. These circumstances certainly called for new magic, a new means by which Walpi might reclaim some power, if only the power to explain these circumstances to themselves. Nupaljari is slight of frame, and as we sit on the ground talking, she intermittently rubs a section of puckered skin on her neck and a long, shiny scar on her right calf. She tells me there is a metal plate in there. She survived an horrific car accident 3 years ago in Adelaide, in which the driver died. Her recovery was long and difficult. She used to drink, she tells me, but not since that accident. That's when she found God. Nupaljari tells me that in recent times, another kind of Djanpa have also started appearing. Djanpa who are not dangerous, just hungry. They enter houses in the night and they take food. In the morning, when people wake up, they find their cupboards and refrigerators empty. They know it wasn't people who ate that food, it was Djanpa. Trees at Hooker Creek. As we've seen, Larry Djungarai's Djanpa pictures prompted his brother's daughter to talk about terrifying killers. But when Jerry Djungala looks at the Djanpa pictures made by his classificatory big brother, A.B. Djungala, he speaks of countrymen. On looking at these drawings as we sit together out the back of the Wanayaka Arts Centre at Lajamanu in August 2013, Jerry Djungala becomes animated and tells me a series of stories in quick succession. One story tells of the time Jerry Djungala was camped in the Kupalunu area with his family. He was about 6 years old. They all went to collect bush fruits. At the conclusion of their harvest, the family regrouped and made camp at the base of a river red gum tree. They ate and rested a while and then dispersed to go hunting again, everyone except Jerry Djungala. The boy stayed behind, eating more of the fresh fruit. As his relatives walked away, Djungala saw what looked to be a man and his family appear, walking towards him. When he saw these people, he was no longer able to eat. His eyes began to sting and his body felt numb. The family were Djanpa. The Djanpa man, who Djungala knew as his classificatory father, came close. He threw dust in front of Djungala and he picked him up. He said, "Djungala, I want to take you." Then he took the boy southwest to Mulga country, to a place called Mandala. He kept Djungala there until late afternoon. Meanwhile, his family were unaware that Djungala had been taken. They were hunting in another direction from the camp. The Djanpa looked after Jerry Djungala, fed him goanna and kangaroo, and then brought him back to his family. By then, everyone was looking for him. His mother was crying. They thought Djungala had been taken by Djanpa or by a snake. When he was brought back to his family, Djungala had an unquenchable thirst and quickly threw himself down to drink from a rock hole. Then he vomited violently. Djungala's father was a ngunkari, a healer, and he treated the boy to undo the effects of the Djanpa's powers. Djungala recalls he was so exhausted by this episode he couldn't walk around for several weeks. In Jerry Djungala's telling, Djanpa visits were not unusual or frightening occurrences for his family because they regarded these Djanpa as Walalja, countrymen. Djanpa are tricky, the subject of curiosity, they are dangerous and mysterious, they abduct children and dogs, but they're not necessarily killers. Djungala tells me he still sings for Djanpa at Kudaji initiation time. Djungala moves from sharing these stories of Djanpa deeds to describing the etiquette of how people should move through country. We can't just walk in like kariya and say, "Ah, this is nice country, I'm going to take this country." We've got to talk to that country, apologise to that country, Otherwise, we might have that goanna and we might get sick. Country might not have the right feeling for me. Country and people feels. Country gives back if you treat it properly. If you want to cut wood for a campfire, you've got to treat that country properly. Such matters of moral attitude to country and its resources are crucial to older Walpi people, and they acquire heightened sensitivity where much movement of people has occurred. In speaking of apologising to country, Jungala indicates the appropriate attitude of a man who has been introduced to, rather than directly inherited, ownership of a place. And these concerns bring me to another series of drawings made by Larry Jungerai, drawings that Mervyn Meggett identified as trees at Hooker Creek. Depictions of trees, trees recognisable to the European eye as trees, are a strongly recurring feature through the drawings Meggett collected. 55 drawings cleared for public viewing include what Meggett describes as representational depictions of trees, trees drawn in numerous ways by numerous picture makers. John Berger reminds us that a picture of a tree depicts not a tree, but a tree being looked at. So how do Walpi people look at trees? One way to address this question is through language. Watia denotes a generic class of trees, shrubs, wood, and also spears. But in most contexts, Walpi will identify specifically named species for particular purposes. Different species are favoured for making fire, for erecting humpies, for shaping spears and carving boomerangs. The Tanami Desert is vast. The southern and northern regions are populated by different species of trees. Different species are directly linked to the locations in which they grow. Such locatedness, in turn, confers authority and ownership on particular persons and lineages of persons. Identified as such, and most significantly, trees are actors in the ancestral order. Specific trees are identified as named persons, deceased relatives incarnate. In this highly dynamic process, trees acquire sacredness by virtue of becoming conception sites, the places where babies are conceived. Thus, in shorthand, in Walpi reckoning, to draw a tree is no neutral act. Attitudes to trees and to pictures of trees enact wider Walpi ways of ordering relations between persons and places and the world at large. Consider the story Jerry Jungala told me in response to my question of how he came to have an outstation on Gurindji land at Luljoo, just a few kilometres from the Hooker Creek settlement. He tells the story in two parts. The first locates his personal circumstances in relation to national events, notably the 1967 referendum, which has been hailed symbolically for the spirit of inclusion it extended to Aboriginal people and for making an historic shift that would follow to a less paternalistic governance regime. But in Jungala's telling, the significance of the referendum is marked very differently. As Walpi became free people who could drink, his life cascaded out of control. He, like many other Walpi, hailed the role of Christianity in helping him regain sobriety and steadiness in life purpose. Jungala's move out of the Hooker Creek settlement to occupy Luljoo with permission of Gurindji owners is integral to the story he tells of how he managed to steer a path back to regain control of his life and the capacity to help others. In the second part of this story, Jungala enfolds Luljoo, what he calls his little station, firmly into his family's intergenerational trajectory. And he does so by telling me about three trees. He starts by pointing out the large Wirrkali bloodwood tree that stands prominently adjacent to the tin houses. This is a sacred tree, and has become so since Jungala's family came to occupy this place. It marks the conception site for the first generation of children born to Jungala's family who camped beneath that tree before any housing had been established. Jungla then points out a Unity bean tree, now standing several metres high, planted, he tells me, from a seed he brought from his mother's country. Finally, he points out a Nurkul snappy gum tree he transplanted from the banks of Hooker Creek. As Jungla's story and actions compellingly suggest, trees mark itineraries, journeys made by persons, in this case from ancestral country to settlement to outstation. In Jerry Jungla's telling, the bringing of these trees to this place secured his moral claim and provided a special kind of ontological anchorage, quite literally marking the uprooting and re-embedding of people in a new place. Looking at this drawing, Jungla declares his elder brother Abi put the right one for this area. He points out the pencil figures of Emu and Goanna that he tells me reside in countries adjacent to Papinya. He tells of a kind of hawk, Kurukalanji, who picked up a snake at Wanambiji and brought him through Papinya to a soakage called Mungaladi. The snake fell from the bird's mouth into the rock hole at Papinya and kept travelling to Kupalunu. The rounded black elements across the top of the drawing might be the deep rock holes atop Kupalunu Hill. The rainbow Jerry Jungla identifies in Abi's picture travelled from Kupalunu to Christmas Boar. He goes on to speak about the many lines of rain activity in the area, as well as the Kunya Kunya song his father knew, a song to slow the rain, to make it more gentle if there were violent lightning storms around. Water, snake, emu, they were all friends, all countrymen. They travelled together a long way, says Jerry Jungla. In separate conversations, I learned that these important rain places are now lost. Sometime in the 1970s, there was a great storm that washed away the sacred tree and soakage at Lungarajara. A number of expeditions to find these places, the most recent to the Kupalunu area about 10 years ago, have been unsuccessful. As A.B. Jungla's drawings suggest, this is deep sandhill country, inaccessible by car. When Walpree walked out of that country sometime in the mid-1940s, driven by curiosity to visit the nearby cattle station and new settlements, they were unknowingly leaving those places behind, quite possibly for the last time. Just as the media of song, story, and drawing become mechanisms for holding on to lost places, they also provide the means by which people can picture themselves in new places. Could it be that in Jerry Jungla's tale of journeying and the claim to authority and legitimacy at stakes lies an explanation for Larry Jungrai's drawings of trees at Hooker Creek? Is it not the case that the making of these drawings can be understood as part of this process of coming to terms with life in a new place in a similar way to that which we see in Jungla's life history, only this time in crayon and paper? It seems a compelling proposition, but it's one that is roundly rejected by Jerry Jungla and other senior Walpree men who remain deeply bewildered by Larry Jungrai's trees at Hooker Creek. If Mervyn Meggett were right that Larry Jungrai was deeply caught up in drawing the trees at Hooker Creek, and if Walpree people in the present are also right that he had no authority to do so, then these drawings would appear to mark a significant moment of rupture. They distill one response to the turbulent circumstances of exile. While the forced relocation to Hooker Creek may have been traumatic for many Walpree people, one man, at least, seems to have grasped the opportunity with energy and openness to the new possibilities that might follow. It's an attitude we see echoed in the creative activity of the next generation of Walpree, especially Japangari Poulsen, whose responses to the drawings kicked off our journey. Deeply philosophical in his observations of the European world and the peculiarities of Kadia ways, Japangari also took great pleasure in what he described as the freedoms he had acquired through techniques and technologies Kadia brought into his community. An avid maker of portraits, Japangari recalled with pleasure the new ways of picture making, the new ways of seeing he acquired in the classroom of his teacher and friend David Tunley. "We learn to see the country in a new way," he told me. Mastering the art of line making in the classroom was as crucial to settlement life as the labour I spoke of earlier. And this watercolour is the only work included in the exhibition that is not a drawing. In attempting to look back to the world of the 1950s with the aid of archival research and the guidance of my Walpri interlocutors, this research has unavoidably maintained a focus on how Walpri people see their place in the world today. And in moving to conclude this talk, I want to consider two drawings made by Walpri women in the context of my research. And these are two of more than 200 drawings that were made across a whole series of workshops and other activities. If Meggett's time was the time of the privileging of male ceremonial knowledge, in the present, it is the work of women that dominates Walpri cultural production, particularly for the market and a wider audience. Prompted by my suggestion that it might be possible to do so, just for fun, Biddy Napaljari Timms, a woman well into her 70s, drew herself as a figure clothed in trousers, this blue figure here, that she recalled wearing during her time as a young woman washing dishes on the Mount Doreen pastoral station. She drew this blue figure reluctantly and very quickly added another, her sister, here, with hunting implements, digging stick and carrying bowl, but this time depicted in the classical iconography of arc and lines, and without pause surrounded them both with her ngalyupi snake vine dreening. Her move seemed similar to Jerry Jungler's polite deflection of my request that he talk to me about Hook Creek. The ground of post-settlement experience is not the neutral place of authorised storytelling. There are complicated and risky politics to be waded through in pitching oneself into this new kind of public territory. Stories of life, vernacular tales, both Jungler and Napaljari indicate, must be framed by what Walpri commonly incite as proper ways of talking for places, persons, events. No one can just speak about any place. History might be collectively held, but talking for the circumstances of a place is an authorised activity. A similar rhythm guides the approach many people have taken to drawing in the course of my research. When invited to draw memories, events recalled from long ago, many people would first draw the dreamings and countries they commonly paint in acrylic, as if laying the ground of their publicly recognised identity, before making pictures of events witnessed or scenes from early life, and concluding with another dreaming picture. Lizzie Naparula Ross was an exception. This 34-year-old woman, Larry Jungerai's granddaughter by adoption, is a radio DJ and a video maker. She loves music and has a riotous sense of humour. Lizzie communicates her daily dilemmas in love and life through regular status updates on Facebook. When invited to draw something from memory, an event from her past life, Lizzie eschews classical iconography and gives us point perspective, the horizon, the lone figure, herself, walking along the road into the setting sun. The picture's composition reveals the strong visual influences of her European education as well as Hollywood films. "Look at me as a creative, independent individual," this picture seems to declare. "Do not presume to characterise me through the prism of kinship and dreamings. Do not look backwards in order to understand who I am. I'm focused on the future." Now, we might be tempted to read Lizzie's picture as a statement of radical transformation in the way Walpri persons see themselves and their place in the world, a statement that also speaks to wider debates about the future of remote Aboriginal communities. But we must note the direction in which she is walking. Lizzie is not heading for Alice Springs, but rather west along the Tanami Road into the desert. In this sense, if this drawing looks to the future, it is a future that is less than clear. Lizzie's description of her drawing similarly refuses to admit finality. She is walking and thinking, not leaving. This drawing appears to enact a similar sensibility to Larry Jungerai's Mullica's House. The confident stride of Lizzie's black figure, heading toward the radiant setting sun, resonates with Jungerai's attention to the light shining within the house. Both pictures seem to distill uncertain, future-focused hope. And perhaps it is this sensibility of uncertainty that has made the present an apposite time to bring the Walpole drawings out of the archive. Mervyn Meggett did not write about them because the drawings posed a different set of questions to those with which he and other anthropologists of his time were concerned. Six decades on, a time we might say coloured by uncertainty, not just for Walpole, but for all of us, such questions acquire a new resonance. In glimpsing through these drawings something of the remarkable journey Walpole people have made over the past 80 years, we also glimpse a space we are invited to occupy. If Lizzie's picture makes a demand on the viewer, it seems to be this: see me in relation to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Melinda, for that. It was terrific, and I hope that you've all enjoyed it and have got some ideas and thoughts that maybe you want to discuss outside. And as I said, Melinda's got her book there if you'd like to purchase a copy and to get her to sign it. And also there's some food and some drinks there as well. Thank you all very much for coming.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.